A já jsem Matěj Skalický, and this is Czech Radio News Podcast Vinohradská 12. Vladimir Vladimirovič Putin. Lazy dictator who wants to be a powerful tsar. British journalist Catherine Belton gives her analysis. Catherine spent years as a correspondent in Moscow. Now she works for the American newspaper, The Washington Post. It's Saturday, June 7th. Hi, Catherine. Thank you very much for joining us on this podcast here in the Czech Radio building.
Thanks so much for having me here. It's really great to be here.
Quotation. We fought Sweden for 21 years. How long are you ready to fight? So these are the words of Russian envoy Vladimir Medinsky, said to Ukrainians at the meeting in Istanbul, Turkey. Is Vladimir Putin as determined as Tsar Peter the Great in the war against Sweden?
I'm afraid he is. He somehow has it in his head that he should be the next Peter the Great, that he is going to be the gatherer of the lands. And I'm afraid this is an unfortunate accident of fate, perhaps, because during the pandemic, he was isolated, alone with the history books, and only with a few of his closest advisors, we're told, Yuri Kovalchuk, his old friend from St. Petersburg, who convinced him of this great need to restore Russian empire. And I think this had always been with him, but I think had it not been for the pandemic, had it not been for the fact that he was isolated from his perhaps more rational advisors, perhaps he would never have embarked on this adventure. But now for him, it's his quest. And I don't think he believes he can stop.
We can blame the pandemic. But do you see any parallels between the so-called Northern War in the beginning of 18th century and the Russian invasion and Putin's war with Ukraine?
Well, I think, you know, Russia, I mean, Putin obviously feels that Ukraine is historically part of the Russian Empire. And you even heard this from Putin going back to 1992, when he had his first state position after so supposedly resigning from the KGB, whether he actually did or not is another question. But in that interview, when he was the supposedly very democratic, very progressive deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, he blamed the Bolsheviks for the collapse of Russian Empire. He said that the Bolsheviks tore up the country into republics that never existed before, and they cast fairy tales about something that should never have existed. And so he always had this dream of Russian Empire and of restoring it. And we can also see this as well from his own book of interviews just before he became president in March 2000. And then he recalled that, you know, when he was a KGB officer in Dresden, watching protesters gather outside the KGB house after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And he'd been, you know, he was really upset and frustrated because he wanted the Soviet military to come and provide backup for the KGB safe house away from the milling crowds. But nobody answered the phone at the nearby Soviet military base. And then when they did, they didn't do anything because they were awaiting the orders from Moscow. And he basically then said, you know, I felt like we were abandoned, we'd abandoned our position in Europe. And he said, I wanted something different to be proposed in its place, but nothing was proposed. Soviet authorities then had just given up and walked away. So all these things have stayed with him, and he really sees himself as an empire building, no matter how far reaching that might
be. And it's interesting because the story is all over again. Because also the Peter the Great, he wanted to regain the so-called lost territories of the Russian nation. And so the Putin wants to do the same in his view of the world.
Yes, unfortunately. Yes. I mean, I think as well, it's that great sense of humiliation after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union. And he really in his eyes, he believes he is restoring Russia as a great power. But he could take other ways of achieving that and, in fact, perhaps be more successful. You know, he could have built Russia into a strong, vibrant economy with its resources. They really could have taken on the world, but in a kind of market competitive way. But instead of that, he's chosen to invade his neighbors and also try to undermine and disrupt and divide Western democracies.
Yeah. Russian political analyst Andrei Kolesnikov, he wrote that Peter the Great opened a window to Europe, but Putin is bordering up with rotten planks from the time of Ivan the Terrible. So maybe Putin's more Ivan the Terrible, not the Peter
well,
the Great.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think he likes to think of himself as Peter the Great, but also as this sort of great reformer. But unfortunately, the Ivan the Terrible analogy is much more apt, because along the way to achieving these great imperial ambitions, he has been completely undermining the Russian economy. I mean, of course, he would say, we have withstood sanctions. Look, we have this new alliance against the West. The West does not dominate the global economy in the way that it did during the communist era when there were embargoes against the Soviet Union. We can survive because we do trade with China, with India, with other BRICS nations. But actually, that's just a cover-up for this great rot that's going on inside the Russian economy, because we can see it very clearly just in their headline figures. I mean, inflation officially is at 10%. Unofficially, it's probably double that. They've had to boost interest rates to more than 20%, than our 21%, and they have been for several months now. And people can't afford to pay back loans. Even the country's biggest corporations are not making payments. And even his closest ally, the guy who's head of the state arms conglomerate, Sergei Chemizov, has warned that there's a string of bankruptcies coming up.
And so, everything is connected with the war industry now. The weaponry is shrinking, by the way, from the Soviet era as well. So this is something he needs to rethink. Mm. And, you know, in the 25th year in the Kremlin, he needs to think to the future. Does Putin want to stay in power?
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why he embarked on this war as well.
So 25 years is not enough.
Yeah, I mean, once he changed the constitution to remain in power, he had to conjure up a reason for being there. And I think without a war, without having conjuring up this idea of a great external enemy, what was he for? Why was he still in power? What was he doing for the Russian people? So it was another part of the great myth-making that goes on behind the Kremlin walls.
Have you seen the propaganda film made for the 25th anniversary of Putin staying in power? The Russian state TV made a propaganda film. There's a scene from a shiny kitchen when Putin is taking a bottle of kefir from the fridge and he's offering it to a reporter. He looks very tired, I think, and worried, emphasizing how hard he works late. Is this the image Putin wants to project to the world? A humble, tired, old man fighting for the rights of the Russian people.
Yeah, I mean, he's very good at creating myths, creating propaganda around his own image. But actually, we know from at least one of his close former allies who knew him really well in the first two terms of his presidency, he said that actually he's quite lazy. He never likes to get up early in the morning. Mm-hmm. He doesn't arrive at work till 11 or 12 at noon. And, you know, and he likes his luxuries. And that's, he is kind of obsessed with the trappings of
power.
That's
a typical thing for dictators, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, especially when you've been in the job for so long. And I think we've seen that very clearly in some of the investigations that Alexei Navalny did into his palace on the Black Sea. Where,
yachts and all the gold.
Yes, I mean, again, it's an ostentatious display of power. It's there to project power. But of course, when he's pretending to be a man of the people, of course, he projects a very different image. That said, of course, I do believe it's true that he works very late. So that's another reason why he doesn't get up in the morning.
I have one more name of one more tsar or emperor, Russian emperor, to mention, because in the footage, in the film, in the propaganda film, there's also a portrait of the Emperor Alexander III, a strong authoritarian leader from the late 19th century who promoted Russification, but he didn't lead any war at the time. This doesn't fit well with Putin's nature. So why his portrait in his flat in Kremlin?
You know, I'm not actually sure because, you know, I've heard from other people close to Putin. There was one ally of his who's a French businessman who was always very close to Putin. His was a former Russian aristocrat and he was brought up in Paris after the Russian Revolution in 1917, or at least his family was. And he was one of the people who instilled in Putin's head that it was the best idea to restore Russian Empire. And he tried to instill in his head that he should rule for as long as Catherine the Great, or at least this is what he told him, he said, just after Putin became president. And I think Putin, to that degree, also is following Catherine the Great's footsteps. There are others from among this kind of ex-Russian imperial aristocrat community who've spoken about how you have to follow the edicts of Nikolai the First, who really was a dictator as well, that you have to have this knot with three elements to rule Russia, that you have to have, I think it's the fatherland and kind of religion. And it doesn't matter whether religion is just basically a fig leaf to replace communism, because that's what bound the country together. And you have to have a ruler, an autocrat, a czar, that there has to be a strong figure at the helm. And that without these three elements, then Russia will fall apart. And these are the figures that I know from kind of Putin's history that he's been told to follow. So I'm not really sure about Alexander III, to be honest.
Speaking of the warmongering efforts of Putin, does he have full support from his closest allies to continue in the invasion, in the war with Ukraine?
I would say that there is a division. But I think those closest to him, who are the most hawkish, are very much for continuing the war. They believe they have the upper hand militarily, that the West is weak. And unfortunately, we're showing ourselves to be weak. And they look at Donald Trump, who every day seems to walk away from his ultimatums. And they believe that perhaps Europe is now there for the taking, because we see the rise of these strongmen, far-right populist figures across Europe who have a very different attitude towards Russia than most of the European establishment has until now. So I think they think that they're winning and that they can afford to keep going. But I was speaking to some Western officials a couple of weeks ago, and they think that actually that's quite a risk that Putin's taking, and that Putin might actually be misinformed about the true state of affairs on the battlefield. Because one, for the last year, Russia has only managed to take 0.6% of Ukrainian territory at a rate of losing 1,500 men a day, either killed or wounded. And that's a really high casualty rate. And now that's a total of about 1 million, according to these Western assessments. And, you know, and at the same time, Russia always used to have this seemingly inexhaustible supply of Soviet-era tanks in storage. And Russia would modernize them, send them to the front line. And I'm told by the Western military experts that if you're going to break through the Ukrainian front line, you need to have tanks for afterwards to secure the territory. I mean, it's fine, you can break the front line, but without the kind of the heavy armored vehicles, you might well get kind of pushed back quite easily. So I think, you know, the assessment is that by sometime next year, Russia will be facing critical shortages of both manpower and this type of heavy armory. Of course, Russia has an inexhaustible supply of drones and missiles, but you can't take territory necessarily just with drones and missiles. You need armored vehicles as well. So, you know, he's kind of, as Trump put it, playing with fire.
you were speaking about the lack of information or the manipulation or, you know, the decisions that we can see in Putin's mind, it's somehow inflicted by the people around him. I read your one of the latest pieces in the Washington Post, and you mentioned that the former Russia Security Council Secretary Nikolai Patrushev may have manipulated Putin on certain occasions. How?
Yeah, I mean, so Patrushev, he was always more senior than Putin. He was older than him. He had a more senior rank in the KGB, and he moved to Moscow before Putin did. Putin stayed behind in St. Petersburg when Patrushev moved to Moscow in the mid-90s. And Patrushev had always been kind of like this dominant force in the relationship, despite the fact that Putin became the president. Patrushev was FSB chief in the first years of Putin's presidency. And he, I'm told, according to people who were close to Putin during those first two terms, that it was Patrushev who was the kind of the driving ideologist behind kind of using capitalism as a way to undermine the West and restore Russia's kind of imperial might, but using capitalism as a way of doing so. And that he, you know, he's very dyed-in-the-wool kind of Cold War ideology, sees the world through a zero-sum lens. I don't think we know whether Patrushev manipulated Putin into the invasion, but it's certainly the case that at that infamous Security Council meeting, just days before the full-scale invasion, you know, when Putin was laying into his foreign intelligence chief, Sergei Naryshkin, and asking everyone, like, what he should do about Ukraine. And Patrushev was the only one then who didn't appear cowed or frightened in some way. And he said, well, you know, Vladimir Vladimirovich, we could go and talk to Biden and the Americans again, but we all know that they've decided already. And he said that Ukraine poses a threat to Russia's territorial integrity and we have to deal with it.
But that fascinates me. That all goes down to the KGB people, because that's the outcome of your book, Putin's People, that it's the KGB-based system.
I'm afraid that's true. And that's why we see them kind of, you know, again, like I said at the beginning, Putin could have made Russia great again and made it a great power by building a strong, vibrant economy. But because of his background in the KGB, I think these paranoias about Western intentions prevail in his head, whether they're real or not. And he really sees the world also now through this Cold War KGB lens, in which kind of Russia's wealth, its strategic wealth, its strategic cash flows are to be used to play the same games that they did during the KGB days when they were kind of using active measures to divide and disrupt the West, planting disinformation, assassinating rivals, funding political parties. Only now, it's what they do is kind of a gazillion times magnified, and it's a much more difficult thing to trace because, of course, in the Soviet era, our Western banking system was pretty Stone Age. You know, there were numbered Swiss bank accounts, which were quite difficult to trace, but now you've got gazillions of offshore shell companies and money whizzing around the world, also even faster now through cryptocurrencies. So it's very easy to fund subversive activities against your rivals in the West and get away with it.
You've already quoted Trump, the role of Trump in the talks between Ukraine and Russia is quite an interesting story as well. Is Trump in this whole story a bystander, a third wheel, or a real mediator?
He's probably none of those things, I would
say. So what's his role?
I think he wants to be a mediator. That's how he sees himself, as the great bringer of peace to the world, or at least that's what he thought he was going to achieve until he uncovered that it's actually much harder to do than just snap his fingers, because he believed that he has this great relationship with Putin, and therefore Putin will listen listen to him, and he's the only leader in the world who can bring peace between Russia and Ukraine. And obviously that's proven not to be true.
But it seems that he's not that naive anymore.
Yeah, I mean, he's starting to realize, because people within his own Republican Party are very loudly saying Putin is playing you, Putin is tapping you along. Trump is still resisting, because I think he really likes the idea of the kind of the strongmen leaders, and he wants to kind of be a superpower along with Putin, in which they get to carve up the world between themselves. And I think, you know, Putin and his allies really kind of lighted up as soon as Trump wanted to lay claim to Greenland or the Panama Canal, because they believed, well, this is a guy who's just like us, you know, we'll take Ukraine, you can have Canada and Greenland, and we'll just carve it up between ourselves, and international norms no longer have to be obeyed. So they appeal to that side of Trump, and they've very cleverly installed a guy to appeal to Trump's business sense in the talks, Kirill Dmitriev, who is Putin's special envoy for the economy, and he is old friends with Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law, and they're just offering all these business deals, and they put him there, I was told, specifically to appeal to Trump's business sensibilities. So we still don't know what's been agreed in these talks that Trump's own special envoy to Russia has agreed to, Steve Witkoff, because when he goes into the Kremlin, he doesn't have his own translator from the embassy. He has one supplied by the Kremlin, and there's no one taking notes. So we don't know what's been agreed. It may be that they've agreed to some business deals, and therefore Trump by now is just making a show attempting to bring peace, but really he wants some commercial business deals with Russia. Or I don't know. That's the thing. Putin also doesn't know how long can he string Trump along. And we and the rest of the world will be finding out in the weeks to come for how long Trump's patience can continue.
And do you think that Putin will fall for that? For any business deal offered by Trump in the end?
Well,
because
I think,
we see a lot of threatening now, but no stricter sanctions, no steps towards to press him.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the thing. So I think there is some degree of unease in some circles in Moscow, because they think, they worry about Trump's patience wearing thin eventually, that he could impose tougher sanctions. They think they should just take the deal where they stop at the current front line in return for a partial lifting of sanctions, so the Russian economy isn't irrevocably destroyed. But I think Putin clearly believes that he has some kind of leverage over Trump, and whether this is Putin's offer of business deals to Trump, we don't know. I mean, obviously Trump has got the minerals agreement with Ukraine, but we don't know. Maybe Putin's offered him other resources in Russia. We just don't know. And I think we're all going to be on the edges of our seats in the weeks to come. I mean, how long can Trump keep saying the same thing over and over again about, you know, how we want peace, this war must stop? Surely he has to realize that it's sounding increasingly hollow.
I started with the Northern War. The Northern War lasted 21 years. And Russia won it eventually through patience, largely through patience. So it's reasonable to expect that the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, the Russian invasion to Ukraine, could last 10 more years, because we are already in the 11th year of the war.
That would be tragic, to be honest, because obviously there is huge loss of life on both sides. I would like to be optimistic and think it can't continue for past the next year, but we just don't know. Not sure whether the world would get used to this constant state of war. I guess we already have to some degree. We see Europe now transforming, especially its defense industry, which is really stepping up at the moment to supply Ukraine with weaponry. And I think even though Putin thinks that time is on his side, in fact, as long as Europe continues to support Ukraine, as long as we remain united. Actually, time is more on the side of Europe and Ukraine, because Putin now has actually inflated expectations among his own population that the war is going to end. And people have been signing up because they want to take the money, because they think they're only going to be fighting for a couple of months, not for years and years. And as we see, we saw just 2 years ago when Yevgeny Prigozhin, the mercenary leader, led that incredible uprising in which his men nearly marched all the way to Moscow.
Yeah, he was marching to Moscow.
You know, we can see the fragility in the system, and Russia's economy is in a really bad state. Mm. And as long as Europe continues to support Ukraine, the European economy is much, much stronger than the Russian one. So I wouldn't put odds on Russia being able to drag it out for 21 years this time and emerge with the upper hand.
Okay, thanks for the prediction. Thank you very much for all your answers and the interview.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
And that's all for today. I spoke with Catherine Belton, a reporter with the Washington Post. Thank you for listening.